Okay. So now I'm going to skip a few sweet intake. And we'll do this other sweet dose tomorrow in China. Because if you're going to do a death contemplation, I thought it would be good to do a sutta about that topic before we actually do that. So if you can go forward a few pages, what is it, 3 or 4 pages? 4 pages, yeah. And we get to a sutta called Delicate, AN 339, the one. That's 4 pages forward there. Where were they? Got it? Yeah. Okay. So this is the one. So this is all about contemplating things. So it's a continuation in the sense of right and virtue. And how to contemplate things. And the idea with all of these kind of contemplations is to abandon the defilements and to kind of get the mind ready for meditation practice. This is the purpose of all of these things. And this one here is also about that particular topic. So let's just dive into it. So this is how it goes. This is another one of these autobiographical suttas where the Buddha talks about his own life and before his awakening and what he did to move forward on the path, so to speak. This is what happened to him. Because I was delicately nurtured, most delicately nurtured, extremely delicately nurtured. At my father's residence, lotus ponds were made just for my enjoyment. In one of them, blue lotuses bloomed. In another one, red lotuses. In a third, white lotuses. I used no sandalwood unless it came from Kasi. And my headdress, jacket, lower garment, upper garment were made of cloth from Kasi. By day and by night, a white canopy was held over me, so that cold and heat, dust, grass, and dew would not settle on me. Yeah, so, and I had 3 mansions, one for the winter, one for the summer, and one for the rainy season. I spent the 4 months of the rainy season mansion being entertained by musicians, none of whom were male. I did not leave that mansion. While in other people's homes, slaves, workers, and servants are given broken rise together with sour gruel for the meals. In my father's residence, they were given choice hill rice, meat, and boiled rice. So here is the Buddha talking about his life before he renounced the world and became an ascetic. And this gives you some idea of what his life was like. And this is one of the very few passages from the early suttas where the Buddha actually talks about that. So it's quite, that reason is actually quite interesting here. This particular passage is found in a few places, and it's, of course, as always, standardized in these places. And what is interesting about this is that it's relatively low-key here. When you read later literature in the Pali language, the commentaries, that sort of thing, and you read things like, where is it explained? I think the Buddha Vamsa and some of these books, maybe the Buddha Vamsa, Charyapitaka perhaps, and Jatakas and whatever it is. When you read about the life of the Buddha before he became the Buddha, it is often kind of made, actually the Jataka Nidana, that's what it sounds, yeah. It is often kind of exaggerated to the point where things are completely out of proportion. And you often find that, you know, the capital city of the Sakyans, Kapilavastu, was this magnificent capital, enormous. And the Buddha lived as a prince in this place, and he lived this enormous mansion. And everything is so fabulous and kind of exaggerated, way, way over the top. And but the reality is actually a lot more simple. The reality is basically what we're seeing here. It would have been very similar to this, probably, what actually happened before he renounced his home life. So still, it is obviously a luxury, but it's kind of luxury but it's within the bounds of reason. So it's kind of, this is sort of thing that is kind of acceptable, I suppose. And that fits very well with what we know from India at the time. If we look at the archaeological evidence, and as I said before, I think if you're going to be a Buddhist, you want to be as undeluded as possible. You want to be as straight about things as possible. So you want to take into account all kinds of evidence when you look for the truth. Yeah? So archaeological evidence is one of those things. So we take that into account. If our idea as about Indra doesn't match the archaeological evidence, well, we've got a problem. We've got to find some solution to that. And if you look at the archaeological evidence, things were fairly simple at that time. Actually, there isn't very much archaeological evidence at all. And the reason is that in those days, things were built out of perishable materials, right? Wood, bamboo, that kind of stuff. It wasn't built so much out of stone, which is a later development. The stone and brick period in Indian building really starts with Ashoka, which is about 100, 150 years after the Buddha. And prior to that, everything seems to have been built out of things that perished and disappeared. The only exception is some of the mounds, some of the walls that you have around cities, right? They were built of clay very often, so they can still be found in India today, this ancient kind of fortifications, if you like, around, found around villages and towns at that time. And the only big city from that time that has been dug out in any kind of scale is Kosambi, I think I mentioned that before. And Kosambi was actually dug out, and if you look at the size, I think it's estimated that it would have fit maybe a few thousand people, maybe a maximum a few tens of thousands of people in there. So it's quite a small scale. Right, and these were the largest, the most massive cities in India at that time. Only later on did they have much larger cities. And it's only later on that you have things like, the really large city later on is what is now Patna, which was Pataliputra, and that became the capital of the Ashokan Empire. And of course, that is actually quite a sizable city. But anything before that was actually very small. This fits that idea, right? It's fairly small scale. It's not kind of completely out of bounds when it comes to what we should expect for that period. So it's kind of sweet, right? In those days, three lotus ponds were made for my enjoyment. That's how young men enjoy themselves in those days, with lotus ponds. Yeah? No Xbox or anything like that, right? it's kind of... present day sounds pretty boring, doesn't it, from my present day point of view. And then he used no sandalwood. Sandalwood I'm not exactly sure how it was used, probably as incense maybe at that time as well, I'm not entirely sure. But either this is a luxury wood at that time, sandalwood. Yeah, and it came from Kasi, as did all the clothes that he was wearing also came from Kasi. So Kasi was the capital of luxury at that time. If you wanted luxury goods, you went to Kasi. So this means that he was living in luxury. This is what this basically says. Where is Kasi? Kasi is another name for Benares or Varanasi. Yeah, so if you go to India today, you can still go to Kasi. This is what sometimes India or Kasi is. Kasi actually is known as the eternal city, because you can't really find any beginning for Kasi. It seems to have always been there pretty much, which of course is a massive exaggeration, but it has this kind of sense of eternity about it. And when you go to Kasi now, it is still the capital of luxury goods, especially of cloth, right? You see here, it says that all his clothes were made of cloth from Kasi. And if you go to Kasi now, they kind of grab hold of you and they want to pull you into a shop and they want to sell you cloth, yeah? Nothing has really changed. Exactly the same, 2,500 years later. And this is what is kind of cool, right? If you think about Europe 2,500 years ago, it's kind of living in caves and stuff, right? But in India, it is still kind of the same after 2,500 years. So this is actually one of the nice things about going to India. I did mention that before in brief, is that you see these things that are still the same as in the suttas. And it makes the suttas come alive as real historical documents. You understand that these are not just made up, this is not just fantasy, this is actually describing something that did actually happen 2,500 years ago. And it's not just here, it's not just about Kasi, it's many little details like that. There, if you go to Rajagaha, well, capital of the Magadhan Empire, it has very distinct geographical features. It has these big hills or mountains going around it. And these are described in the suttas. And you go there, you can see exactly what it's like. It was called the Giri Banja. Giri Banja means a hill fort, or the fort within the hill. And you can see exactly why that is the case, because it is surrounded by hills and it's sitting in the middle. There were like two narrow entrances on either side there. And one of the things that you had in Rajagaha, you had the famous hot springs, also mentioned in the suttas. You go to the same spot today at the foot of exactly the same mountain, and what do you find? A hot spring. Yeah, it's true, it's there. All these Indians, that's it. Now it's more kind of structure. All these Indians are there bathing in the hot spring. So exactly what happened at the time of the Buddha. And so when you go there, you get this feeling of almost like walking into the suttas, taking a step into the suttas, like walking into this ancient text in a sense. And it brings everything to life because you get this feeling that these are real historical documents. And when you just read the books, it's hard to get that feel. But then you do when you actually go to India in this one. And what is, of course, what is even more interesting about that is that all of these geographical information or historical information that you have in the suttas, that is a secondary type of information. When the suttas were recited at the first council, the main purpose of recitation was to recite the word of the Buddha. And then at the end of the recitation, the person in charge of the council, that was Mahakasapa, he would ask, actually maybe at the beginning, he would ask, where was the sutta recited? And then Rajagaha, right, or Savati or whatever. Who was it recited to? Oh, it was recited to so-and-so. Right? Yeah, so that information, which is kind of outside of what the Buddha spoke, what you might call the narrative or the story or whatever you call it, that was only added later on, at the first council, probably some of it even after that. So that is going to be much less reliable because it relied on memory after the event, maybe years, maybe decades after this thing actually happened. That is uncertain, but even that information, when you look at it, actually turns out to be reliable. You go there and you see exactly what is going on there. It's still the same to the present day. And that gives you, again, it gives you this feeling that, well, certainly those parts that were most important for the ancient Buddhists, which was the word of the Buddha itself, well, they would have kept that intact in an even better way than actually all of this insignificant information on the side there. This is this feeling that this whole tradition of oral tradition of passing on the suttas from one generation to another one was a very conservative and careful tradition whereby they actually tried to keep it intact for future generations. It's one of the outcomes of this kind of investigation, which is very, very interesting in its own right. So that is the Kasi, the luxury capital of India. It was actually funny, we have an Indian monk in our monastery here. Yeah, that's quite nice, isn't it? We have an Indian monk. It used to be that we would have to go to India to get ordained. Now they come to, you know, Australia to get ordained. It's really nice. So we have this Indian monk who comes to us. I was discussing with him about these kind of issues. And I said, talked about Kasi. I said, Kasi kind of, you know, means Benares. And he said, yeah, that's right. Actually, my grandfather, he used to use the word Kasi for Benares. So it's kind of, you know, see things kind of coming together very nicely in that sense. Then he says here, interestingly, my headdress, jacket, lower garment, and upper garment were made from cloth from Kasi. The lower garment is the Antara Vasakana. Upper garment is the Uttara Sangha. And these are exactly the same words that monastics use, exactly the same garment that monastics use from that time until the present day. This is called the Uttara Sangha. Yeah? The lower robe is the Antara Vasaka. And so exactly the same thing. So in those days, monastics and lay people probably didn't look that different. They looked pretty much, you know, quite similar. Yeah? Now we kind of stand out, right? to say the least. But in those days, it actually was quite similar, which is interesting, because it kind of, you wonder, because we have been pretty much, they didn't look exactly like this, because upper garment was probably a bit shorter in those days, and all that kind of thing. There was slight difference, isn't it? But it makes you wonder whether, you know, are we supposed to wear exactly the same thing after 2,500 years, or should we kind of go with the fashions, and should we wear jeans, perhaps? It would be the same, right, if you had monastics wearing jeans, it kind of would take away some of the fun of being a monastic. but still, interesting that in those days, there wasn't that massive separation between monastics and lay people in the way you look. The difference at that time was that lay people, they would have a bit more, they would be a bit more fancy, right? They would have kind of, a bit more fancy in terms of colors and shapes and that kind of thing. Yeah, that would be the difference. Whereas monastics would have very plain robes. So that would be what it was back in those days. Anyway, I'm not going to go too much more into that, I think. But of course, if you look at the history of monastic dress, it has changed over history. You go to China, Mahayanas, they dress very differently. They actually have trousers, and they have jackets, so they actually look quite different. So it certainly has changed, at least in some traditions. So. Anyway, by day and by night, a white canopy was held over me, so cold heat, dust, grass, and dew would not settle on me. That sounds kind of luxurious. So. I had 3 mansions, one for the winter, one for the summer, and one for the rainy season. So here, you have to be a bit careful. The word for mansion here is pasada. And of course, sometimes you have to be, because of this tendency for exaggerating what the Buddha's life before he ordained, before he became an ascetic was like. This exaggeration sometimes makes its way back into the suttas. Because you read the commentaries, and the commentaries say, oh, he lived in this massive mansion, in this palace. And this used to be translated as palace. He had 3 palaces. Yeah. You can see how this kind of gets exaggerated all the time. But the word pasana actually doesn't mean either mansion or palace at all. And what it means, I think, and this is something I researched in a little bit of depth, because I was translating these things, so I had to do a little bit of research. And what it seems to mean, it means a filth house. Yeah, and this is what you see often if you go to Asia and you see houses on stilts, because you have the monsoon, and then when you have the monsoon, you have lots of water and things. So to safeguard the houses, you have them on stilts. And that seems to be the meaning of this. And that doesn't really imply anything in terms of size. It could be any kind of size. Yeah, and this kind of takes away some of the exaggeration of this. So you have to be a little bit on the lookout for these kind of things. And then he spent the whole rainy season in the mansion just being entertained by female musicians. And he did not leave that mansion for those 4 months. So again, this idea of enjoyment, indulgence, and this kind of thing. And then the last part here was quite nice, because this kind of adds another little bit of flavor to this. And it says that in other people's houses, slaves, workers, and servants are given kind of food that isn't quite up to scratch, right? Broken rice, sour gruel. Doesn't sound very nice, is it? Broken rice and sour gruel. So that's what, if you were a slave, you didn't kind of get the best of food. But in the Buddha Thubi's house, you had choice rice, meat. Meat obviously was a luxury at that time, and boiled rice. Yeah, and this is a nice little touch on this particular sutta, because it shows you that it wasn't just a wealthy household where people lived in luxury. It was also a compassionate household. You look after everyone. You weren't treated badly just because you were a slave or even a servant. Yeah, and this is kind of a nice touch. So that obviously is the kind of thing that you would expect the Buddha, presumably, to grow up in a reasonably sensible household like that. Anyway, that's the background. That's the story, the only story found in the suttas about how the Buddha to be lived prior to renouncing it all. And now we come to the main part of the sutta, the part that really matters. And then the Buddha says, amid such splendor and a delicate life, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to old age, not exempt from old age, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who is old, overlooking his own situation. Now I too am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who is old, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with youth was completely abandoned. So here it starts off by saying, in the middle of this splendor and very delicate life, right? The point of that, of course, is to say that it doesn't really matter what kind of life you have. This is regardless of what kind of life you have, this is going to be a problem anyway, the fact that you're going to get older eventually. So that is kind of irrelevant, the splendor and all these kind of things. It also points out that the Buddha had an ability to see through the kind of superficial things in life. And then he says here, the uninstructed worldling. And the uninstructed worldling in the sutta is the asuttama putujana. Putujana we have seen before, the ordinary person. Putu, many, dhamma, person, the many person. uninstructed asrutva means who hasn't heard quite literally. So it means someone who hasn't heard the suttas or hasn't heard some kind of good teaching. That is what is meant by this. So there is like a whole range here of people you can imagine. The asrutva protrujana on one end, and then you have the arahant or the noble ones on the other end, and everywhere else somewhere in between. So if you have heard a little bit of teachings and you practice a spiritual life, you're already moving a little bit away from the asrutva protrujana. You're somewhere in the middle there, moving in the right direction, hopefully. That is what that refers to, the uninstructed worldling, the person who has no kind of sense of any spiritual life whatsoever. And then, when a person like that, when you see somebody who is old, sometimes you feel kind of repelled, right, humiliated and disgusted even. It's easy to feel that way. You see somebody who was really, really old, and when they come towards the very end of their life, everything is falling apart. Nothing is, can't see anymore, you can't feel very much, you need everything that you do has to be taken care of, you have to be washed by others, absolutely everything. You're completely incapacitated pretty much towards the end. The closer to the end you get, the worse it tends to be. Right? And sometimes it's almost a bit kind of a repelling when you see that. It's almost kind of hard to bear. That's why we push them off to some kind of old people's home and somebody else, some professionals look after them, because it's often easier that way. We don't even get to see these things so much more in our day and age, because other people look after old people. But it's useful to remember that. It's useful to kind of bring this to mind, that this is our nature as well. We're going to be there one day. It's already inside of us. It's waiting to come out. Yeah. Where there is youth, there must be old age. These are two sides of the same coin. You can't avoid that. We know it in one way, but we don't really know it deeply enough. And this is the problem. And because we don't know it deeply enough, it tends to distort our outlook about reality. So if you are humiliated and you are disgusted when you see an old person, really, who you are, what you are disgusted a little bit by yourself, because you have the same nature. We are all going to be there. So if I feel disgusted when I see an old monk kind of not being able to look after himself, well, really, I'm disgusted with myself in a sense. And so it's very powerful to remember that. Yeah. And then you kind of, once you realize that, you kind of let go of some of that horror at becoming old. You realize it's already here. The point here is not to make us kind of depressed, right? That is not the point of this. Oh no, I'm going to, boy, it's true. I've forgotten all about old age and now he's reminding me, I don't want to hear about this. This is not the point. The point is just to clarify things, to remember the nature of reality. Because if you forget the nature of things, you make all kind of crazy decisions. This is the whole point about delusion. When you are deluded, when you're not really seeing things according to reality, that's when you make bad decisions. Yeah. So the whole point here is just to remind ourselves, this is the nature of things. And then you will be better able to make good decisions for your life as a consequence. So please don't allow these things to get you down. Yeah, feel negative. I know some people talk about death. They kind of, oh, I don't want to hear about death. It's terrible. But actually, the point of hearing about death for old age is to actually improve your life and not to actually make it worse. This is what happens usually. If you use it in the right way, it improves your mindfulness, improves your ability to stay in the present moment, and all of these things. And that, of course, is what this is all about. So, and not only, of course, is it about old age. Once you start to look at things in this way, to remind yourself that all of these things are already inside of you, kind of waiting to come out, yeah, old age is already here. It's just, it's going to get much worse than it is already. Not only is that there inside of you waiting to come out, but all other things are there as well. Sometimes we kind of discriminate in the world and we feel kind of superior to others, or we feel that some people we don't like, or some nationalities we don't like, or some religions we don't like, or whatever. But remember, all of these things are inside of us. Right? Every culture on the planet, every nationality, every religion, both either gender or genderless for that matter, or any age, education, social standing, all of that is already part of us. And one day, we too will be reborn in that situation. We have been in the past. Yeah? So we have to be very careful with discriminating against others on whatever basis, on whatever foundation, because if you do, you are really discriminating against yourself, because you too have been there, and you will be there again in the future, unless you make an end of this whole samsaric existence. So we are all part of the same thing. We can't differentiate between each other in these ways. And this is one of the great things about the idea of rebirth, because then you actually recognize that we're all part and parcel. We all have these qualities as part of us, right here, right now. There is no difference. And that is, I think it's a beautiful way of thinking about things, because it makes us feel more like brothers and sisters across all cultures, across all divides. It takes away so much of that division that you find in humanity. They look different. They come from a different culture. They're a different gender. They're a different age. Right? All that kind of doesn't really matter so much. All that is kind of irrelevant. We're all part of the same, all part of this in a very real sense. So when you do that, then you kind of take away this idea, and you take away this one of the interesting things here comes a bit further down in the sutta, is that when you forget about this, actually it says right here, when you forget about the fact that you're going to get old, you feel intoxicated. You feel like, I'm young, right? I'm strong and healthy. I can do whatever I want in life. And then that's exactly what you do. You do whatever you want. Not what's sensible, but you do whatever you want. And that is part of the problem. So intoxication in Buddhism is not just about alcohol. It's about anything that kind of distorts your mind. Alcohol is only one of them. This is another one. Another one would be kind of getting intoxicated by sensual pleasures. Anything which kind of distorts our mind is a kind of intoxication and a problem on the Buddhist path. So this is why we remember this. And when you remember that, then that intoxication actually is either abandoned or it is diminished, because you know that this is kind of where you're heading. And of course, if you get old, you're also heading towards youth again, from a Buddhist point of view. So it's kind of always alternating in this way, changing back and forth, always changing it. So that is the old age contemplation view. And if you do that, if once you remove some of these intoxications and problems, of course the idea is that mindfulness starts to arise, because intoxication is gone, and you start to get your priorities right in life. You understand what actually matters, what is kind of a silly waste of time, and what actually is useful if you're going to use this worldly existence in a wise way. So that is the first one of these. So let's go on to the second one. Again, it occurred to me, an unobstructed worldling, though himself subject to illness, not exempt from illness, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who is ill, overlooking his own situation. I too am subject to illness and not exempt from illness. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who is ill, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with health was completely abandoned. Health and illness, two sides of the same coin. If you are healthy now, you're bound to get ill in the future. If you're ill now, it means that you will hopefully get healthy again. You should get healthy again in the future. Either you die and get healthy, or you get healthy in another way. Another possibility. But again, two sides of the same coin, right? And like Ajahn Brahm has a very nice saying, and I'm sure some of you will have heard anyway. And it's saying that when you go to the doctor, you should never say to the doctor, "Doctor, doctor, something is wrong with me." That is the wrong way of thinking about it. When you go to the doctor, you should say, "Doctor, doctor, something is right with me. I'm sick again today." And then your doctor will check your mental health first of all. But that is the truth, right? It's nothing has gone wrong when you get sick. Actually, this is the nature of this body. That's to be expected. Even if you go mentally sick, nothing has really gone wrong. Mental illness, mental health, these are kind of two sides of the mental life. Sometimes you get mentally ill, next life you're healthy again, kind of going back and forth. This is to be expected. So the same thing again. So remember that. And again, this idea of seeing somebody who is really sick and not getting humiliated by it or repelled by it. In Australia these days, they have something they call plain packaging on the cigarettes. I don't know if you've heard about that. plain packaging means that the if you have a cigarette brand, you're no longer allowed to really advertise your brand. I think in the UK they have recently done that as well. They're passing some legislation, I think, about that. But in Australia it's already been for a few years, and so you can't really advertise your brand so much. You're kind of allowed to have Marlboro, but it kind of has to be in very plain text, right? It looks really boring, Marlboro, you know. There's nothing to it. And then they have this big picture here of somebody who has some kind of smoking-related illness, yeah? Like lung cancer or cancer of the throat or of the mouth or something like that. And, you know, some of these pictures are and they have kind of the before and after pictures, right? So you have this young, handsome young man, right? And then you have this kind of wretch next to it, complete wretch next to it. And it's fascinating because when you see that, it's like, oh, it really is quite repelling, right? You can see that inside of you. But then you remind yourself when you see that, actually, this is the nature of your body. This is exactly how it goes. Yeah, this is how it's going to be in the future. And then when you remember that, it kind of clears out your thought again, and it kind of makes it, these things don't seem so terrible. And then you kind of go with the flow rather than kind of carry on and do stupid things. Actually, those cigarette packets in Australia are quite nice, because they have this picture, they have a big warning sign, right? They have small little letters saying Marlboro, big warning sign on the bottom. And then they have to have a certain color. It's supposed to be as unattractive as possible. So they did all this research on the worst possible color that you can have on the cigarette packages, right? And the worst possible color is a color which looks almost exactly like the color of monk's robes in Thailand. I'm not joking, it's actually very true. This robe here is actually not so bad, but there is another color they use in the northeast of Thailand, which is kind of greenish brown, which is quite kind of disgusting, and it looks almost exactly like that. So it's amazing what kind of research that you go into just to get the tobacco, to kind of get people off tobacco. Anyway, so that is just a little bit about the idea of illness. And again, it kind of makes you, cools your mind down, clarifies things, make your priorities right. This is what this is all about. It's about enhancing your life quality, not about reducing it. Then we come to the third, the last one of these, and this is death contemplation. And this is by far the most important one of these. And in fact, death contemplation is something that you see throughout the suttas. The Buddha talks about it in many, many different places. It's called either Maranasati, which means recollection of death, or it's called Maranasanya, which means the perception of death. And you see it in many, many places. And when you see it across the board, everywhere, you know that this must be a significant and important teaching. And in another sutta, not this one, he specifically says that this Maranasati, and also the other ones as well, they are for everyone. Yeah, he specifically says this is both for monastics and for lay people. Both for male, female, monks and nuns. Everyone, it includes everyone. So because he specifically says that, it must mean that it is a particularly powerful type of contemplation. So the way it is expressed here is pretty much the same way as the other ones are expressed. Again, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to death, but not exempt from death, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who has died, overlooking his own situation. I too am subject to death, and I'm not exempt from death. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who has died, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with life was completely abandoned. Yeah, so this is the death contemplation, just the reminder that we are all kind of going to end up in this particular way there. And the purpose here, and the point of this, part of the purpose here, is to take away so many of the petty, silly little things that we think about in ordinary life, all the desires, all the anger that we have. And remember, all of the desires, pretty much all the desires we have, and all of the ill will that we have, they relate somehow to this particular world. Yeah, this world is where all of these things belong. And now we are about to leave this world. If you do the death contemplation, it's a bit like feeling what it's like to leave this world, depart this world. Yeah, and when you know that you're going to depart this world, you're going to put all those silly little desires, that ill will that we have, you're going to put it aside because it's irrelevant. You're leaving this world, for goodness sake, right? You're moving on. Why, you're not going to think about your kind of your next relationship or your new BMW or anything like that if you're about to leave this world. Yeah, you're not going to kind of argue with people when you're about to leave this world. You're lying on the deathbed about to kind of die and then you start an argument with somebody. No, it's not going to happen, right? You're finished with that when you're lying on your deathbed. You just want to be peaceful. You want to be left alone. You don't want to have anything to do with all of that. So, and you have, sometimes you may have seen that. You have seen, you know, people who are dying well. And very often, when they die well, they will lie there on the deathbed and they will be very peaceful. You may have seen that. These are people who have understood a little bit about the nature of life. Yeah? And the reason why they are peaceful is precisely for this reason, because they are able to give up their attachment and the things that relate to this world. And when you put all of that up, then of course the result is peace. It is ill will and desire and attachment. These are the things that make us unpeaceful, because they drive us into the future, they drive us into the past, and all of these kind of things. So the purpose here is, instead of waiting till you actually die, when it's usually too late anyway, you want to bring some of that peace into the present moment. Yes, you want to try to imagine what is it like to die. Yeah, and then imagine that, and then bring it into the present moment, rather than waiting until it actually happens to you. Usually, if you wait and it happens to you, usually it's too late anyway. You haven't got any practice, you don't know what to do. And then kind of, well, you don't know what's going to happen. Maybe you are lucky and you're kind of wise enough to do it well, but maybe you're not. Yeah. In any case, it's very useful to bring it into the present moment, because it becomes a support also for your meditation practice. Right? You can use the Maranasati first of all, reflect on death, and if it works well, you become peaceful, and then you can go to the breath. Then we can do the metta meditation or whatever else. It can be a nice stepping stone to move you forward in your meditation practice. So it has lots and lots of benefits in this way. And this is what is so nice about this. So what does the Buddha say about this? How are we supposed to do the Maranasati? And the first thing is to remind ourselves that death is always uncertain. It can happen at any time, right? This is the kind of the scary thing about death. We always think it is in the future. But maybe it isn't really so much in the future. Maybe it's much closer than we think. I'm supposed to live till I'm 80, right? If I don't live to 80, something has gone wrong. No, nothing has gone wrong. If you only live to, I don't know, how old? I'm not going to ask you how old you are. How old are you now? Okay. If you are kind of 40, right? Maybe I'm going to live till you're 40 and 2 months. Yeah. So that things are coming very much more closely than you think. And this is the problem. The problem is to kind of remember that the causes of death are always much more close to us than they actually seem. You step into the street. I must admit, the German drivers are really good. Sometimes if you go to some countries, other countries, whoa, it's really scary. Some of these other countries. Go to India, for example. You think you can die at any moment because the drivers are so crazy here. But this is the problem, right? You step into the traffic. You never know. Well, I'm sure you have drunk drivers in Germany as well, like everywhere else. You always have some crazy people there. You're in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's not your fault, and suddenly you had it. Or you just walk into the forest here, and you stumble on something, you fall over, and bam, you die for some kind of weird reason. Or you have a cancer in the body right now. Don't come feel any cancer, right? But maybe it's here. Yeah, I have a sister who has cancer. Father who has cancer, maybe, quite possibly, there are some cancers. I think we probably all have some cancer cells in our body all the time, probably, just waiting to kind of sprout forth and kind of multiply and kill us. Heart disease, right? Sometimes you just fall over, you have no idea. So it's important to remember this doesn't just happen to other people. You read in the newspaper, you think, yeah, they have died. And you don't really realize that actually that could be you. It seems a little bit foreign. It seems like somebody else. But actually the point is, if somebody else can die like that, there is no different, it's no different from you. It can happen to you as well. You think that, oh, I'm young, it shouldn't happen to me. It may happen to you. And this is the problem. One of the great things about being a monastic, when you We do a lot of funeral services for people, and it's great to do funeral services because it really reminds you of the nature of life. And most of the funeral services we do are for old people, right? They are 70s, 80s, 90s, and even more than that sometimes. But sometimes it's middle-aged people. Sometimes you see people exactly your age. You think, gee, that looks a bit like me. That's a bit kind of, that's kind of an eye-opening when you see that. And sometimes it's young people, people in their 20s perhaps. Yeah. And sometimes even younger, all the way down to little babies who have died. And so you start to realize the uncertainty of this life and how kind of unreliable it is and how anything can happen at any time. And this is one reason why you want to draw the attention to death into the present moment. Because if you are going to be ready to die, you have to be ready now, because it is so uncertain. If you're not ready now, you're not going to be ready when it actually happens. Precisely because it always feels like it's in the future, but one day it's going to be real. Yeah, and then you're not going to be ready. Now is the chance to be ready. Now is the chance to kind of feel what it feels like to die. What does it do to your mind if you know that you have no future in this world? It does, and if you do it in the right way, it becomes very peaceful and very beautiful. And this is the point of this whole meditation practice, or this whole contemplation. It doesn't have to be meditation. A contemplation practice is a nice way of looking at it as well. And there's another thing that the Buddha has to say about this, and that is how close we should make this death contemplation. So he asks the monks, he says to the monks, do you do Maranasati? Do you do recollection of death? And one monk says, yeah, I do recollection of death. And he says, well, how do you do it? He said, oh, I think tomorrow I might be dead. And the Buddha says, well, that's not really what I was kind of, that's not good enough, right? So then another monk said, oh, I think kind of this afternoon I will be dead. And not, still the Buddha kind of dismissed it. Another said, after the meal I will be dead. Still the Buddha not too impressed. And then one monk says, well, I think, when I'm eating, I think I might be dead on the next two or three spoonfuls that I eat. Now the Buddha is kind of, okay, this is kind of getting better. And then eventually there's one monk who says, the way I think about this, I might be dead on my next breath. Yeah, and that is where the Buddha is kind of satisfied with the answer. So the idea is to bring the idea of death so close to us. And this is really difficult to do. Right? Imagine that you might be dead on your next breath, right? It's very, very hard to do, to really imagine that. And not try if it kind of makes you feel strange, because it is a little bit strange. But the idea that on your next breath, you might be dead, right? It's very interesting. And that is kind of where the Buddha said what we should try to do. And then kind of we have brought it in close enough. Because then the mind really turns to the present moment in a very powerful way. But don't start in that way. You do it gradually, right? You take it very slowly. You might be dead next year, perhaps, or in the month's time, or the week's time, or whatever. And you move it forward, and you see how closely you can bring it to the present moment. Next breath is a very high bar to clear. That is what that's the ideal, right? When you really kind of do this very, very intensively. So this is then the purpose of all of this. The purpose is to give rise to mindfulness, to avoid all the desires and all the ill will that are kind of bound to this world. And when you abandon all of that, mindfulness becomes strong. It really draws you into the present moment. And you feel, wow, because the future, you're going to die, the future is unknown. The past is kind of gone because you're living this world. So you're here. There's nothing else, right? Future and past are gone. What is left? Just the present moment. So it's to draw you into the present moment in a very powerful way. And one of the things that happens when you do the death contemplation is that you start to realize the kind of the things that you have to abandon in life. Yeah, what kind of things where you are attached to. When you start to think you're going to die, you start to panic. Oh no, what about my family, my friends, right? I'm going to have to leave them behind. You start to see and feel some of your attachments. That is also very useful. And if you, when you do this contemplation regularly, you abandon some of those attachments gradually. And of course, the things that we have to let go of when we die are obviously all our belongings. Right? That's pretty obvious. But what is interesting, this is kind of really interesting actually, you find around many cultures around the world, people are not really willing to give up their belongings when they die, right? They want to bring those belongings with them into the next life. Yeah. So this is a couple of examples of that, right? Some of the in the Chinese culture, the Chinese culture is a very complex culture, all kinds of things coming together. You have the Taoist, you have the kind of Confucianism, you have Buddhism, you have the Chinese ancestry worship, and all these things come together in Chinese culture. It's a very kind of mixed hodgepodge of many, many things there. But one aspect of Chinese culture, sometimes when you go to Chinese funerals, it's not very common these days among modern Chinese people, but more traditional Chinese people, they have some of these traditional things that they do at funeral services. And one of the things they do, they have these little paper models, right? They have a paper model of a car, maybe, or a house, paper money, yeah? And what they do, and this is how desperate we are to take our belongings with you into the next life, what they do at that funeral, they burn all of these things, and then the smoke rises, goes up to heaven, and you take these things with you when you go on into the next life. Yeah, this is the idea, and it's not. I'm not trying to make fun of Chinese culture at all, because this is a very standard thing in cultures around the world. The Vikings were exactly just as silly as this was. The Viking age, when a Viking was like a chieftain, right? He was kind of the boss of the village or whatever, and he would often have a big Viking ship. So when he died, his belongings would be put inside the Viking ship, and then his wife's also put inside the Viking ship. Really cruel, right? His wife, they were still alive, for goodness sake. And then either they would bury it somewhere, or they would put it in, on the ocean and burn the whole thing up. And everything would burn up. And the idea, again, was that you want to take all your wives and all your belongings into the next life, into the heavenly world. So this is how crazy we become at the end of our lives. We cannot accept that even our belongings are going to be gone. We want to make sure we take our bank account with us into the Devaloka. You don't need a bank account in Devaloka. There's plenty of it. You have enough when you go to these other rebirths. Forget about it. Leave it behind it. So, but I think for most people who are practicing on a spiritual path, we get this. We get that we have to kind of give up our physical belongings. And I suppose most of us are fairly at ease with that. But of course, more difficult than that is to give up all our relationships, yeah, family, friends, all the people who are close to us in the world. And you can see that when a husband and wife, or, you know, have lived together for a long time, a whole life, and then the husband or the wife dies, the other partner doesn't know what to do with themselves anymore. They feel completely lost. I was just speaking to Venerable Anāyo. He lives with his parents, and his mother, he said, died recently. And they said his father completely fell apart, right? He didn't know what to do anymore when his mother passed away. This is so common when you have couples who live together for a long time because of that attachment that is there. It's almost like they become part of you. You don't have, almost like you haven't got a separate identity anymore. It's like you become two, merged into one being almost. Yeah, and this is what attachment is about, is the idea that our identity almost extends outside of us. We take other things as part of our identity. And this is very difficult then when we are about to pass away, because we realize we're going to have to let go of these things. It's a very powerful moment when you die. Yeah, very, very, so many things you have to let go of. Then there is your body. Yeah, your body has to go. And the body that we all look after so much, that we train and we keep it in good shape, and we do all kind of things and make it look nice and all this kind of stuff. And eventually it ends up in a small pile of ashes. Yeah, that's all that's left of the body. Ah, the body, this used to be this body of mine. All that's left is this pile of ashes after the crematorium. Okay, that's the body. So, wasted so much time on that body, isn't it? And now there's nothing left of it. Yeah? Plus the body has to go. And actually people find that difficult as well, to let go of the body. But there's even more. And the other thing, which is of course interesting, that you have to let go of. So much of our identity also has to do with this world. What kind of position we have, you know, in society, our social position, what position we have within the family, our education, our religion, our nationality, all of these kind of things make up our sense of self. And then when you have to die, all of that has to go as well, because it's all tied to this world. There's nothing much left, right? Almost everything has to go. And the only thing that you have left when you die, there's only one thing really, and that is the mind that you take with you from this life into the next one. So that shows you that what you really need to focus on in this life, it gives you some idea. What you need to focus on is to make sure that you create a mind that has as many good qualities as you possibly can, so you can actually take something valuable with you when you pass away and then move on into the future life. It's a very powerful way of thinking, because once you see that, you realize that the silliness of investing all your time and effort into something which is so limited in time, and then you die, and you've got nothing left. And people come on there, but they feel really confused, because they have spent their whole life investing all the time and energy into things that belong to this world. Now you have to leave this world behind. And they feel at a loss. They feel confused. They feel, what was the point of all this? Right? So then you change your, like I like to say, you change your investment strategy here. Yeah? And you invest into the big picture, the long term, rather than investing in this tiny little life that we have right here and right now. And that investment is, of course, in all the goodness, the kindness, the meditation, all the things whereby you create a beautiful mind for yourself. This is like creating good karma, if you like. It's all the same, there's different ways of talking about the same thing. And that you bring into the future, and it carries you on into the future existence in this one. It's a whole new paradigm, a whole new way of thinking about things. Very useful, and very powerful way of thinking here. So this is the idea of death contemplation, and this is some of the outcomes of that. And as I mentioned before, we're going to try that tonight. Please only do it if you feel at ease and comfortable with it, because these things sometimes, and fair enough, sometimes people find these things are uncomfortable. That's okay. You don't have to feel bad about that. That's just a little bit of a preview of what's going to happen tonight. So then let's finish off this sutta. That's the death contemplation. We'll finish off the very last part here. There are, bhikkhus, these three kinds of intoxication. What three? Intoxication with youth, intoxication with health, and intoxication with life. An uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with youth, engages in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. With the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, even in hell. So, idea here is that when you are intoxicated, you look like you are drunk, you don't know what you're doing. So as a consequence of that, you end up doing all kind of stupid things that have a long-term negative consequences for you. This is really all that means, I suppose. And exactly the same for the other ones. An uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with health, engages in misconduct by body, speech, and mind. With the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. An uninstructed worldling, intoxicated with life, engages in misconduct by body, speech, and mind, with the breakup of the body after death, he is reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. So, again, the problem with being intoxicated, we don't understand what needs to be prioritized. We forget about what really matters in this life, and then we end up doing all these stupid things as a consequence of that. And then we have the very last paragraph here, which actually is quite nice, which is really kind of meant for monastics, I suppose. But what it says is the following. Intoxicated with youth, a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni gives up the training and reverts to the lower life. Or intoxicated with health, they give up the training and revert to the lower life. Or intoxicated with life, they give up the training and revert to the lower life. So this shows you that if you want to stay as a monastic for a long time, one of the powerful ways of ensuring that is to do things like death contemplation. Yeah, if you do the death contemplation, in a sense, it's almost as if you have no future anyway. And if you have no real future, which is basically true, then why on earth are you going to disrobe? There's nothing to disrobe for. There's nothing there. Nothing there waiting for you. And then you remain as a monastic because of that. So wonderful little thing, a great reminder to monastics what, you know, some of these things that actually ensure that you kind of, even when you feel a bit kind of on the edge and you kind of, you know, things are always up and down, right? Somebody kind of going down a little bit of a rough patch or whatever, you think, I'm going to die for goodness sake. Okay, relax, chill, and allow this kind of rough patch to pass. Maybe just also very briefly comment here that it actually talks about the lower life. And this is Hinaya is the Pali. What's Hina like? Hinayana, same kind of word. And the idea here is not to kind of disparage lay life or anything like that, but the idea is just that when you are a monastic, then of course that is precisely meant to be the fastest route to Nirvana. And that's why the Buddha would call it a higher kind of life. Yeah? So that's really all it means. It's a relative term of two particular things. But he does actually say that in the sutta. There's actually a word that is used, the word hina. You refer to the lower of two kinds of life. It's actually one of the things that he says in there, which is interesting. It's worthwhile noting these things. Some of these things you may find a little bit challenging. You may find this is a bit over the top. But actually, because the Buddha says it, it's worthwhile taking note of these things, even if they may be a little bit challenging or whatever. Okay, that is all for now. So please keep on enjoying yourself, and we'll see you again at 7:30 this evening.